you are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beattie, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush is headed to Moscow later this week. He's expected to sign a nuclear arms reduction treaty with President Putin, but in Russia, many question the worth of the agreement. The nuclear arms cuts are being made on America's terms, and Russia, Russians complain, is a minor partner, not an equal ally. Anatoly Yudkin is a foreign policy expert at the Institute for USA-Canada Studies in Moscow. I asked him how Russians are reacting to the asymmetry of the new U.S.-Russian relationship.
It provokes public unrest and a feeling of displeasure. People hate to get Gorbachev number two, and that's why it's a risky affair for the President Putin, in my opinion. So he's going there after tomorrow to sign an agreement, which not exactly is popular, not only among the people at large, but among specialists and in elite, I would say.
Is his overture to the West, his seeming to be willing to go even further than the last mile in conceding to President Bush on the missile defense, for example, is this just Putin, or is there an elite behind him that wants the closer relationship with the West? How broad is this interest in closer ties?
I would say, that immediately after the 11th of September, Mr. Putin invited the whole leadership of Russian Parliament Duma to Kremlin, and among 18 persons, only two voted for a partisan approach to this anti-terrorist coalition. And one among them was for helping Taliban.
Helping Taliban?
Yes, and 16 persons are neutral at that time. So my point is that exactly the second Western jump is not very popular among the Russian elite, I would say. In my opinion, not less than 60-70% are very cautious, and they do not like diplomacy of so-called gifts given to foreigners, like Lourdes base in Cuba or Cam Ranh base in southern Vietnam and so on. People hate this type of behavior, this type of diplomacy. We are fed up with Shevardnadze-Kozyrev type of diplomacy.
But what about that? Isn't this just a kind of adaptation to reality? Russia's power of the past is gone, and it needs to adapt to a new world. Isn't there some sort of realism informing the Putin policy?
Yeah, when you are given an order to anybody, it's a realism on your side, but it's a humiliation on the other side.
And is there, in fact, you've hinted at this, a rise in anti-American sentiment in Russia? How does that express itself?
I wouldn't say that there is wide anti-Americanism. I would say that people, the grassroots people, they're surviving the difficult life here. But people which are thinking about the future of the country, they are asking the nasty questions. What are Americans doing in Georgia, in Central Asia? And what they are going to do with Russia? They are not investing in the youngest democracy of Europe and so on. So why they are behaving like this? Are they rude? Are they getting out of the agreements? They are not signing the Kyoto Protocol and so on and so on. So what kind of empire we are getting now?
Well, what does President Putin say? What does he hope to get maximally from this new partnership?
So he would like to get a strong ally facing Muslim world and possible Chinese world. So that's the official or semi, I put it better to say, non-unofficial explanation. So in case Americans are staying on the path of drugs, the prepared criminal, specialist coming to Chechnya, so the Americans are in the right place nowadays. But the question is, are they going to stay here for forever?
You mean in these bases around Russia?
Yeah, if Americans are going to behave like this, so Russia will lose all the sphere of influence they got after the end of the Soviet Union.
Is the nuclear arms reduction agreement that the president and President Putin are going to sign, is that controversial in Russia?
Absolutely. You know, the most substantial one, I mean, START 1 agreement, was around 300 pages. And this was only three pages, not full three pages. So that's the difference.
And it was done in a hurry because the Americans wanted
exactly.
it that way.
And this is the title is, you know, START, Strategic Arms Reduction. There is no reduction. There is storage. Storage of warheads in good American storage places.
And that is not lost on the Russian public, that that represents a concession.
It's bad for Americans, because if Russian storage is not very good, one day criminals or separatists will get it and Americans will be in danger.
There's a kind of vestigial mindset that goes back to the Cold War here, and it's incarnated in the person of Don Rumsfeld in our Pentagon. Is there someone like that on the Russian side?
Yeah, no doubt. There are a lot of people, military, I mean intelligence, I mean people from the old political elite. And they, and people at large, they never behave themselves as being minor partners as we started our talk. So this is something new when we are bowing to the hell. So this is, the boss is coming, and that never happened before the Golden Horde sent it to their cons.
In 1,000 years.
No, 1,000, but since 1480. Mm-hmm. That was the year when Russia became independent. Napoleon, Hitler, Kaiser, Churchill, Roosevelt, nobody, they were equals. But for the first time, there is non-equally partner.
Well, on a lighter note, what do people make there of President Bush's nickname for Vladimir Putin? Apparently, I heard on the BBC that it's Putipoo. Am I right about that?
To be honest, Russians do not like it. Maybe you know that President Roosevelt once called Stalin, as it was in the United States, Uncle Joe.
Yes.
It was the worst possible joke. So I wouldn't suggest to give this joke. You know, in Russia, if you are Tsar, you are Tsar.
Well, listen, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Anatoly Utkin is a foreign policy expert at the Institute for USA-Canada Studies. He spoke with us earlier today from Moscow. The Bush-Putin summit is being billed as a breakthrough meeting that sets the stage for a long-term cooperative relationship between the U.S. and Russia. Can the former Cold War enemies become allies, or is the relationship destined to remain an unequal partnership? Is the Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty an historic achievement or just the appearance of one? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian studies at New York University and the author of Failed Crusade, America and the Tragedy of Post-Communist Russia. Steve Cohen, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's get right to it, Stephen. In the Chicago Tribune a week ago, you wrote, in the 8 months since Putin became a valuable ally of the Bush administration in its war against terrorism in Afghanistan, this second chance to establish a truly cooperative post-Cold War relationship after the squandered opportunity of the 1990s continues to be gravely challenged by Bush's own policies. Can you explain what Bush policies?
Well, Anatoly Utkin from Moscow just told you, and he's absolutely right. I know Mr. Utkin very well. He's a pro-American, pro-Western Russian intellectual, and you could hear how deeply alarmed he is by Americans' policies. Look at it like this. After September 11th, Putin's Russia helped the Bush administration fight the war in Afghanistan more than did all of America's allies, NATO allies, put together. Hmm. I could enumerate the ways, but that's not the point right now. They did. Nobody would dispute that. What did Putin, Russia, get in return? Well, it got in return defeat, rejection, and humiliation. The United States promptly withdrew unilaterally from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which Russia wanted to keep. The United States did not help Russia with its crushing foreign debt. And meanwhile, the United States began to establish what now appear to be permanent military bases in the Central Asian republics, five of them, which were part of the Soviet Union until 1991. Last week, American troops began to arrive in former Soviet Georgia, and I think most telling, instead of putting the expansion of NATO eastward on the back burner as a gesture toward Putin, Bush announced that NATO would continue its eastward expansion next year to the extent of Russia's borders. It will take in the three Baltic republics, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, which were part of the Soviet Union. Now, if you think of international relations as a chess game, or if you're still a Cold War thinker, as I think the Bush administration is, then you will say, good, look at us, good for us. We won the Cold War. We're imposing our will on Russia. But if you take the view that we are a dire threat, in grave danger, nuclear danger, worse than we were during the Cold War, because of the disintegration and destabilization of Russia, then we're doing the wrong thing. And as Mr. Utkin just said, this treaty, this so-called nuclear weapons reduction treaty that's going to be signed in Moscow later this week, has been imposed on Russia. So the short answer is we've unilaterally imposed on Russia things Russia didn't want as thanks for all Russia did to us. And in Moscow, there's a deep, abiding, growing sense of American ingratitude and even betrayal. So I don't think the relationship is stable. This is hardly a breakthrough unless the future is the past, namely the Cold War.
Well, what about this arms agreement? It would cut, it would reduce strategic warheads from about 6,000 to between 2,200 and 1,700. These look like, quote-unquote, historic cuts. At least the White House is saying that. What's your assessment of this arms treaty?
It's a lawyer's treaty, and lawyers could find so many loopholes. First of all, the treaties for 10 years, let me begin again. The reductions are supposed to take place over a 10-year period. There's no pace. There's no schedule. There's no sense of when these reductions are going to begin. So we may be with these extraordinarily high numbers of weapons on both sides for a very long time. Secondly, there is no obligation on either side, and this is the part of the treaty that was imposed on Russia by the Bush administration, to actually destroy either the warhead, that's the nuclear device, or the delivery system. All previous nuclear arms reduction treaties destroyed, dismantled delivery systems. I mean, you can have a warhead in your closet. You can't deliver it unless you have a missile, a submarine, or an airplane. So in the past, these delivery systems were destroyed. Mm-hmm. There is no such destruction in this treaty. Mm-hmm. Moreover, and here's to me the strangest thing of all, this treaty is a kind of television home offer. Try it at home for 90 days, and if you don't like it, you can get your money back. That is, either side can withdraw from this treaty in 90 days, with 90 days' notice. Mm. Now, I don't suspect the Bush administration of doing this, but theoretically, you could cut absolutely not one weapon for just 3 months short of 10 years and then announce you're withdrawing from the treaty.
Well, if this is the picture, why is the Russian president so eager to make this deal and to adopt this new relationship with the United States, including giving the green light, perhaps even encouraging these bases around the Soviet rim, or the Russian rim?
I don't think Putin gave the green light. He put the best possible face on what otherwise would have been a humiliating situation. I can quote his words. When the troops arrived, the American troops, he said, and I quote, "It's no tragedy." Russians tend to think in terms of tragedy, and they're a little more dire in their thinking than Americans. But that's, he didn't say it was a good thing. He just said it's no tragedy.
But why is he making this deal then, and talking this up, this new relationship up?
He's cast his leadership fate, so to speak, since September 11th. As a kind of wager on the United States and George Bush in particular, that he will get out of this at least the symbolism or the appearance of a real partnership, thereby proving to his political class and his people that he, the previously inexperienced Vladimir Putin, is capable of leading even an impoverished and military weak Russia back, as Russians think, to its rightful place on the world scene.
Hold that thought, Steve Cohen. It's an illusion. We'll be right back with you, Steve Cohen. Thanks. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
from Boston.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the U.S.-Russian relationship in advance of President Bush's meeting in Moscow on Thursday with Vladimir Putin. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian studies at New York University, and a Russian historian. Stephen Cohen, you said this new relationship is for Mr. Putin a kind of illusion that he's trying to sort of fool his political class with. But how long can he get away with that? Is there anything that Bush could do that would make it a real relationship and one that would benefit this president who's gone out of his way to benefit us?
Jack, just let me reword the words you put in my mouth.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I don't know if Putin is trying to sell an illusion to his own political class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely sure about what Putin thinks about all this. He's not happy, but he might think he can make a lot out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an illusion in this country to say, as the Bush administration has said, as many politicians have said, and as a large part of the mainstream media have said, that this is an excellent treaty and a breakthrough and some kind of departure from the Cold War, and that it's going to make us safer. I disagree with that. Now, the second part of your question comes to what could we do, what
mm-hmm.
should we do?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, I'm not sure who it was, Jack, maybe you know, maybe it was Churchill, that politicians make policy for today and statesmen make policy for tomorrow.
Mm.
If the White House was thinking in a statesmanlike way, it would first say that the gravest danger to the United States is the insecurity of Russia's nuclear infrastructures. For the first time in history, a fully nuclearized country, there are only two in the world, the United States and Russia, has substantially been destabilized by an economic depression, by social unrest, by disintegration of infrastructure. Therefore, that's our gravest danger. What must we do? We must do everything to help the Russian leadership restabilize Russia. That's our only salvation. That's more important than the Middle East. That's more important than Afghanistan. And it's not just proliferation, but it's Russia's early warning systems that are breaking down to the degree that it's telling computers we're attacking them when we're not. It's nuclear reactors that are going to explode. It's all sorts of things that are unprecedented. So if we agree that that's the danger, then the only solution is the economic restabilization of Russia and its economic development so that Russia can resecure its nuclear infrastructures. Nothing we are doing, nothing that the Bush administration is doing, is addressing that problem. The second thing that we must do is what we must not do. We must not tempt Russia to rely even more heavily on its fragile nuclear structures than it already is. And many of the things that Bush is doing, such as encircling Russia with military bases, such as telling Russia it's okay not to destroy nuclear weapons, just store them, such as moving NATO to Russia's borders, this encourages Russia to rely even more heavily on nuclear weapons and its fragile infrastructure. So the short answer after that long answer is, mm-hmm. it's both what we are not doing
mm-hmm.
and what we are doing.
Mm.
But it could be done. It's a question of leadership. It could be done. And I believe such policy, as I've described, would find an eager partner in the Kremlin.
Mm.
It's about leadership.
About leadership and about, as you say, an American leadership that would look to the problems of the future. Of course, people in Washington point to things like the Nunn-Lugar agreement that supposedly is taking care of the Russian loose nukes. Is that also an illusion? Is anything happening there?
No, I mean all credit to former Senator Sam Nunn and
mm-hmm.
Richard Lugar.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, first of all, that this administration has tried to pick away at that legislation by underfunding it. Secondly, it's underfunded even at best. Just today, I believe, in the Washington Post, former Senator Nunn has an article about this very matter. And he suggests, as do many experts, that Nunlugar, which is designed to reduce these kind of storage problems in Russia and leakage of nuclear knowledge and material, needs to be funded at about 3 to 5 times what it's currently funded at. It is a positive sign, but it's too little, and let's hope it's not too late, but it's only part of what needs to be done. For example, just to give you a quick example, if you agree that Russia is economically unstable, it's living on oil money, and that's going to, when the price of oil goes down, so will Russia. Russia owns about owes the West about $160 billion. It's a crushing foreign debt. You do something about that debt. Why? Because next year, Russia has to pay the West $18 billion to service that debt, and its entire federal budget is $50 billion.
Mm.
Now, to put that in, so our listeners understand what we're talking about here. I mean, none of us have $1 billion, but let's think about governments. We have just increased our military budget by about $50 billion. That increase in American defense expenditure is the size of the entire Russian budget, of which almost a third has to be paid to the West, which means what? There is no money for Russia to invest in its own people. There is no money left for the Russian government to rebuild its infrastructure. That is something we ought to address immediately.
Let's bring in Charles Kupchin. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. Hello, Charles. Haven't spoken to you in a while.
Yeah, how are you, Jack?
Well, I'm fine. You've heard Steve Cohen. He says that the U.S., what Russia has got from the U.S. since it's coming on the U.S. side so strongly after September 11th, what Russia has got is defeat, rejection, and humiliation. Is that your sense of it, too?
No, I would actually put a somewhat different gloss on it. I would agree with Steve that if you look at the last decade, the United States has given Russia the back of its hand and expanded NATO up to its borders and essentially not taken advantage of an opportunity to try to pull Russia westward. I think U.S. policy has actually changed substantially after September 11th, not because of any particular largesse, but because of the reaction to the terror attacks. And it's changed in a way that works to Russia's advantage, in the sense that the U.S. now sees that it needs something from Russia. It needs Russia's cooperation on intelligence. It needs access to Russia's near abroad to get bases that it can use to project power in Afghanistan. And in that sense, I think Putin's desire to turn to the West, to push Russia in the direction of entry into Western markets and councils, is now much more likely to happen. And the U.S. is not yet going the full distance in my mind, but it is, in terms of the NATO-Russia Council, in terms of the cooperation in Central Asia, moving in the right direction. And I disagree with Steve about the bases in Central Asia. I don't think that Putin did this holding his nose. I think he wants American troops there because it's good for Russian security and because it will ultimately improve the relationship between the U.S. military and Russian military.
How is it good for Russia's security to have our troops around the edges of Russia?
Well, as Alexei Arbatov said in the Duma recently, and this is a defense expert who is no lover of the West, We Russians would rather be doing the security job ourselves, that is, fighting terrorism, trying to stabilize the region, but we can't. We don't have the assets, and it's therefore better to let the United States do it than to let nobody do it. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're ultimately happy that you have some American troops in Georgia that are going to train Georgian troops to go into the Pankisi Gorge after terrorist groups, and that they're happy that in the end of the day, they are no longer looking alone at what they see as probably the greatest threat to their security, and that is Islamic fundamentalism in Central Asia.
Steve Cohen, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I like Charles a lot. We used to be colleagues at Princeton together, and I think he's been living in Washington too long. I think he's wrong on all counts. I mean, Charlie's a very smart guy. He's a really good guy. But about Russia here, I just think he's wrong. We need a little history. All this notion that Putin suddenly is turning Russia to the West seems to have forgotten history. That began with Gorbachev.
I don't believe that.
Well, let me finish, Charlie.
I think he's really turned things around in a way that Gorbachev and Yeltsin didn't.
Well, I know you believe that. You just said it. But let me point out to you that it was Gorbachev and Mr. Bush's father who in 1989 announced that they were now partners and the Cold War was over. Why has the second President Bush announced two weeks ago that he's ending the Cold War? We were told it was over in 1989. Clinton and Yeltsin said it was over in the 1990s. Russia, it was Gorbachev who made the fundamental decision that Russia would enter the West through Europe. That was the meaning of his famous slogan of the 1980s, I believe in a common European home. And he went on to say, I think he made a mistake here, but he went on to say, this is Gorbachev, that America is part of Europe. America is not part of Europe. But Gorbachev thought it was. That was the major turning to the West. It's been slow and tortuous. Things happened good and bad after Gorbachev under Yeltsin. So we have to see Putin as a continuation of this process of Russia turning to the West.
What about this picture of the bases, U.S. forces, as somehow in Russia's interest that we're doing their work for them there?
That's my second point. The understanding that Putin and his defense advisors had when our troops began to arrive originally only in Uzbekistan, but there's now an American presence, I think, in five of the East Asian republics, is that their presence was temporary and they're only as logistical support to fight the war in Afghanistan. They now believe it's about oil, as do I. The presence of American troops in Central Asia is about Caspian Sea oil, as is the handful of American troops in Soviet Georgia. 4 days ago, the Georgian defense minister said there are no al-Qaeda troops in the Penkese Gorge. Those troops are there for a completely different reason, to save the pro-American president of Georgia, Shevardnadze, and to establish an American military outpost in the Caucasus. This is how it's now understood in Moscow, and I believe correctly. This is now about oil primarily.
In other words, we want to defend oil pipelines from that region. Is that the idea?
Well, this oil traditionally, rightly or wrongly, but historically, it's been Russia's oil. We now want it to be significantly our oil. And one way to get, you know, maybe you'd agree with that policy. I mean, Charles and I might think, well, that's a good idea. But let's be realistic about what we're talking about. We're talking about oil, not about fighting terrorism. The relationship between the two, there is one, is that to get that oil out, you need to ship it unless you're going to cut Russia in politically and financially, pipelines that don't cross Russia. For that, you need Georgia. But who today, in the right mind, certainly not Exxon, is going to build a $3 billion pipeline across Georgia, which is coming apart at the seams?
Right.
So the hope is to create a political stability in Georgia. I think it's impossible. I mean, not impossible, but I think the United States can't do it.
Well,
they're going to try.
Yeah, let's take a call. We're talking about Russia and the West and the Bush-Putin visit. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. David is on the line. Hello, welcome.
Yes, good evening. I wonder if we're all being a bit naive. This administration seems to be or seems to benefit greatly from conflict, and whether it's the war on terrorism, so-called, or you know, our engagement, so-called, with the former Soviet Union, we aren't engaged with the world such that we're looking towards, I guess, the political ends that would, you know, create peace and so on. It seems to be the very right end of realpolitik, and to the extent that it keeps us engaged overseas in conflict. That's probably one side of it. The other side is, you know, we all know George Bush is in with the oil boys, so there's the other side of it that the gentleman was talking about.
But how are we in conflict with Russia here?
Well, we're certainly not in any kind of constructive engagement. As the gentleman has pointed out, did we drop the ball. And at the end of the day, you know, looking at it theoretically, if tomorrow morning God were to declare peace on the entire planet, And Bush were to have to, you know, just focus his attention at home, forgive me, but I think he'd probably fall flat on his face. And this whole idea of of keeping us engaged in in conflict overseas benefits the administration greatly.
Okay. Thank you, David. Let's take a call from Gene. Gene is on the line. Hello.
Make one comment on Mr. Cohen. All the arguments he uses are arguments of the Cold War. And if we say that we are post-World War II, we are post-Cold War, Russia will benefit as Japan and Germany has benefited. If they will assume, let's say they will flat back, they will lie flat back and just do nothing, and they will still benefit from that if America will put bases everywhere, and the closer to their borders, the better. And Mr. Kupchin, I think, made some of these points. But on the other hand, if this is on the first step of Bush administration, and then the second step to have a treaty, and then if they have many more steps, then cooperation is certainly very possible, especially in the face of many threats the U.S. is facing strategically. So it's a completely new world, new strategy, and we have to think it completely differently. Now, I live in the U.S. for 25 years. I lived in Russia for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to see it. I'm surprised that professionals don't see it.
In other words, to see that with these bases, for example, we're we could do for Russia what we did after World War II for Germany and Japan, which was to defend it. Is
that? And this is just the beginning. Then Russia has all these loans from the West.
Yes.
Russia is actually benefiting all the way after they lost the war. They admitted that. And now they are moving strategically in the right direction because Japan benefited enormously from American bases around. And they spend all their GNP. Of course, Russia lives only from oil. They are in turmoil. They still need to be organized. But I do not see Putin's any mistakes so far. I'm not a big fan of him. And neither I don't see any problems with Bush because how can you do all these things instantly? You have to do it step by step.
Yeah. Thank you, Gene. Charles, he pretty much agrees with your line that this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Well, I'm that would be more optimistic than I'm willing to be, but I would put it this way, that the view that Steve articulates very eloquently is a view that many in Russia would still ascribe to. They would not be Putin's people, but there'd be plenty of people in the military, in the foreign ministry, in the bureaucracy at large. And I think what we're seeing here are sort of two very contending visions of Russia's future and Russian foreign policy running up against each other. What worries me is that I do think Putin is out on a limb here. He is way in front of what you might call the political center of gravity on relations with the West, on Central Asia, on the question of the Baltics getting into NATO and Russia's own relationship with NATO. And I do think that at some point we need to make sure he gets some sort of political payback for going out on this limb. And here I would agree with Steve. That needs to come in the form of economic assistance, improving the day-to-day life in Russia, because that's the best way to say to the Russian people and to Russian politicians, my strategy of orienting us toward the West and
is
having
working.
Closer cooperation with the United States is paying off.
Yeah. Thank you. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about Russia and the West this hour. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the U.S.-Russian relationship. Can the former Cold War enemies become allies, or is the relationship destined to remain an unequal partnership? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Tom. Tom, welcome.
Hi. My question it regards nuclear weapons.
Okay. Go ahead. Oh, we lost your line. Tom, we're sorry about that. Laura, we have a call from you. Hello.
I just wanted to ask about Chechnya and whether calling it terrorism isn't sort of the payback to Putin so that he can call it terrorism, and also what is good for Russia as opposed to what is good for Putin in regards to Chechnya. And isn't there growing Islamic fundamentalism there that can destabilize Russia?
Yes, I have before me the Human Rights Report, the Human Rights Watch report on Chechnya. They speak of forced disappearances, torture, extrajudicial executions by Russian forces. They talk about electroshock torture, disappearances, unmarked graves, large 75,000 Russian troops still deployed there. Steve Cohen, what about her question? Are we doing a sort of favor to Russia by calling what's happening in by sort of blinking what's happening in Chechnya? I should point out that Human Rights Watch also speaks about the Chechen fighters' terrorism, but that they emphasize the state terrorism committed by Russia.
Well, Laura is certainly right to raise the question. You can't have a talk about Russia today or about American-Russian relations without Chechnya. I guess Putin thought in the beginning that one benefit of helping the United States fight its war against terrorism in Afghanistan is that the United States government would officially recognize his war in Chechnya. Let's remind our listeners that Chechnya is one of the 89 administrative components of the Russian Federation, kind of like American state, only not, which is in a kind of condition of breakaway. A civil war against Russia has been going on there for more than a decade. The Bush administration has only come through partially. It muted its criticism of the truly monstrous behavior of Russian troops in Chechnya, but not for a long time. I don't think Putin got a lot from the Bush administration regarding Chechnya, but here's the point. Mm-hmm. I think the American media were wrong in thinking that's what he wanted most of all.
Mm-hmm.
You notice when we began our discussion, I told you the various things that Putin hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mention the administration easing up in its criticism of the Chechen War. After all, we've been critical of that war since 1994 when it began under Yeltsin. And the Russian government understands it's just complete hypocrisy on the part of the United States. We have to criticize it because we're supposed to criticize human rights abuses, but we do nothing by way of punishing Russia. Moreover, it rings doubly hollow now that we are embracing despots in Central Asia who abuse their own people gravely.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. There was there was an article I think in the Washington Post the other day by an American expert on Russia saying the main thing Bush should do in Moscow is tell Putin to democratize more. Well, I mean, Putin's no fool. He knows we've just embraced Karimov, the despot of Uzbekistan, and we're not fussing over his lack of democracy.
Right.
It rings hollow now. I think the real thing that I'd like for your listeners to think about when they think about Chechnya and the Chechen War is that it's the first civil war, because it's a civil war inside Russia, it's the first civil war ever in history in a nuclear country. What does it mean?
Mm.
Well, we don't know what it means because it's never happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you rhetorically what it means. The Russian military has periodically threatened to use so-called tactical nuclear weapons in Chechnya, which would be the first use of atomic weapons since 1945. They haven't done it, but the rhetorical threshold has been lowered. And that some of the Chechen fanatical or extremist fighters, and there are extremists fighting the Russians as well, have threatened to blow up Russian nuclear reactors.
Oh, my heavens. So we're into it.
This is the kind of thing we don't want, and this is why. This is why that, Jack, for you and me and Laura and Gene and all your callers and my kids and grandchildren, the goal, the brass ring, is to restabilize Russia. That includes ending the Chechen War.
Right. Let's take a call from Brian. Brian, hello.
Hello. I'm calling because several of your callers have made the analogy to Germany and Japan after World War II, but I think the more inaccurate analogy is Germany after World War I. Germany had been humiliated, essentially, with the Versailles Treaty and was economically a basket case, and I think that there's similar settings in Russia at the moment and that there's a probability or a possibility of the same kind of right-wing ultranationalist swing in Russia as we saw in Germany after World War I.
Mm. Charles, what do you say about that? Charles Kupchin.
Basically agree with the point in that Russia is in a different position than was Germany after World War II, in which the U.S. had moved in, basically occupied the country, rebuilt its institutions, provided massive martial aid. And in that sense, Russia is in a much more vulnerable position with a weaker economy, weaker institutions, and the potential for some sort of nationalist backlash. And that's why I think it is very important that that Putin is able to deliver some sort of payback for the direction that he's pushing Russia. But I also think that in some ways Putin is making a choice that is Russia's only choice. If they want to advance, if they want to be, improve the quality of life, mm-hmm. the money, the mm-hmm. investments, the technology is all West. It's mm-hmm. not in Eurasia. It's not to the South. It's in the West. The key question is, will he be able to sustain the political momentum to pull this off?
And will he, as you and Stephen both say, get something from the West eventually? What about that? What about that scenario, Steve Cohen, that that we really should worry about a right-wing reaction in Russia?
We should worry about it. I think your caller, I didn't hear his name, he said some very smart things.
Brian.
Historically, he raised the question of precedence, and it's always important to think historically to see if maybe there's something we should learn that we've forgotten. Listeners may not remember that the West, having defeated Germany in World War One, humiliated Germany, and that that brought down the weak liberal democracy in Germany called the Weimar Republic and helped bring Hitler to power. Therefore, one lesson, and I think Charles and I do agree about this, is that under no circumstances should the Bush administration do anything that appears to humiliate Putin or the Russian political class in general.
Mm.
But I think the Marshall Plan is relevant here.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, Failed Crusade, I have about 3 or 4 pages on it, and almost every reviewer jumped all over me, saying I wanted to give Russia Today Marshall Plan kind of money. No, the point about the Marshall Plan is that we, the victorious United States, turned to the destroyed Europe and defeated European countries and said, draw up your own economic plan and we will fund it or help you fund it.
And an important precedent. Steve, I have to stop you there. Thank you. Stephen Cohen is professor of Russian studies at New York University. And thank you, Charles Kupchin. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, remembering biologist Stephen Jay Gould. This is On Point. Famed Harvard biologist and best-selling author Stephen Jay Gould died yesterday of cancer at his home in New York City. He will be remembered as a passionate and dedicated scientist with a unique knack for explaining complex scientific principles in understandable and eloquent prose. We caught up with Edwin Barber, who served as Stephen Jay Gould's publisher for more than 20 years. He offered this appreciation and a reading of a favorite passage from the work of his client and friend.
When I came to work here at W.W. Norton in 1974, I had some time. I didn't have a list to oversee. They take a few years, and so I used to go to the New York Public Library right across the street and just read almost indiscriminately, and I ran across the first piece that Steve wrote. It was in 1974, and it was called Size and Shape, and it just stunned me. I never had read anything quite like it that had its range and its sort of seductiveness. I had never seen anyone who could bring to bear so many everyday interesting things on a serious scientific point. He had a knack for conveying complicated scientific principles to the general public, and that moreover, he had a desire to do so. Most books prior to Steve's were oversimplifications. He didn't take the audience all that seriously. It didn't make the audience work a little. I think Steve always felt that one's reach should exceed one's grasp. If you read his pieces, he will seduce you into them with everyday details and anecdotes, but he will soon get to the major scientific point. He wrote about all kinds of things, why there are no more 400 hitters in baseball, the regression to the mean, you know, why Mickey Mouse is so appealing to us, that sort of thing. But at his core, he had an enormous humanism. And my favorite of his books is called The Mismeasure of Man, which was an attack on the single number theory of IQ. He always felt that such a number would condemn people to a certain niche in society, put them in a box, and deny the human ability to grow. He was a great believer in cultural evolution. So at the end of this book, which is an examination of all of the attempts to test people, to place them into certain categories, he wrote about a very famous case in 1927, and the passage goes like this. In 1927, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. delivered the Supreme Court's decision upholding the Virginia sterilization law in Buck versus Bell. Carrie Buck, a young mother with a child of allegedly feeble mind, had scored a mental age of 9 on the Stanford-Binet test. Carrie's mother, then 52, had tested at mental age 7. Holmes wrote, in one of the most famous and chilling statements of our century, "We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices. 3 generations of imbeciles are enough." Buck versus Bell is a signpost of history, an event linked with the distant past in my mind. The Babe hit his 60 homers in 1927, and legends are all the more wonderful because they seem so distant. I was therefore shocked by an item in the Washington Post on 23 February 1980. "Over 7,500 sterilized in Virginia," the headline read. The law that Holmes upheld had been implemented for 48 years, from 1924 to 1972. The operations had been performed in mental health facilities, primarily upon white men and women considered feeble-minded and antisocial, including unwed mothers, prostitutes, petty criminals, and children with disciplinary problems. Carrie Buck, then her 70s, was still living near Charlottesville. Several journalists and scientists visited Carrie Buck and her sister Doris during the last years of their lives. Both women, though lacking much formal education, were clearly able and intelligent. Nonetheless, Doris Buck had been sterilized under the same law in 1928. She later married Matthew Figgins, a plumber, but Doris Buck was never informed. "They told me," she recalled, "that the operation was for an appendix and rupture. So she and Matthew Figgins tried to conceive a child. They consulted physicians at 3 hospitals through her childbearing years. No one recognized that her fallopian tubes had been severed. Last year, Doris Buck Figgins finally discovered the cause of her lifelong sadness." One might say that Doris Buck's disappointment ranks as nothing compared with millions dead in wars to support the designs of madmen or the conceits of rulers. But can one measure the pain of a single dream unfulfilled, the hope of a defenseless woman snatched by public power in the name of an ideology advanced to purify a race? May Doris Buck's simple and eloquent testimony stand for millions of deaths and disappointments and help us to remember that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Quote, "I broke down and cried. My husband and me wanted children desperately. We were crazy about them. I never knew what they'd done to me."
That was Edwin Barber, Stephen Jay Gould's longtime publisher and friend, reading from the end of Gould's book, The Mismeasure of Man. Stephen Jay Gould died on Monday of cancer. He was 60 years old. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by UR.